Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 117, but who's counting? It's Monday, June 7th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, today I want to start with something a little unusual. I don't really usually do celebrity news, but I wanted to start with this. From Medical Express, what Naomi Osaka taught women, especially black women. Many black women can relate to the challenges facing professional Japanese tennis player Naomi Osaka and the backlash she experienced after withdrawing from the French Open to prioritize her mental health, says Northwestern medicine psychologist Inger Burnett Ziegler. Naomi Osaka's complaint of being asked repetitive questions that lead to self-doubt is one many black women can relate to, said Burnett Ziegler, an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern University School of Medicine. It is not unusual for black women to be in a work situation in which she feels under the microscope and harshly criticized in a way that is disproportionate to her peers. Much of the backlash Osaka has received falls in line with the unspoken belief that women should just do what they have to do and put up with things that are harmful to them in order to pacify others, be agreeable, and keep their good job, said Burnett Ziegler, who researches black women's mental health. Osaka made a bold and brave move by stating her intentions to not do any press in order to protect her mental health and going on to pull out of the French Open. She took some really important steps that are important to recognize. She identified aspects of her work environment contributing to her depression. She did what was in her control to set a clear and firm boundary in order to take care of herself. She prioritized her needs over the opinions and agendas of others. To be sure, not everyone has the same degree of privilege and leverage that she does, but there is a lesson in here for all of us. I second that motion. Well, I would also notice what really struck me when I first heard this story is how this story represents how deeply embedded we are in capitalism and how that is not good for our mental health. So people pointed out that she made $55 million last year. Of course, that's a lot of money. But the impression that was left was that, well, because she can command such great earnings, that she must work and continue to earn those, rather than I think perhaps might be a healthier point of view, which was, well, if you made $55 million last year, you might be able to do some things to actually take care of yourself and have the privilege to do that. So thank you, Naomi Osaka, for being a leader and having the bravery to come forward and address under the scrutiny of the public with mental health struggles that you're dealing with. More power to her. Okay, well, I'm continuing to put a lot of COVID-19 stories up front in the show, but we are moving to a lot less stories, and most of the show will be non-COVID-19. Woohoo! Okay, but let's start with the big question that a lot of us have been asking is, how will this all end? Well, this is a USA Today story. How does COVID-19 end in the U.S.? Likely with a death rate Americans are willing to, quote, accept. How does the COVID-19 end in the USA? Perhaps no end at all, but a resigned acceptance of a bearable level of death. In a good flu season, nearly 100 Americans a day might die of influenza. That 100 deaths a day during flu season is what Americans tolerate, said Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious disease expert at the University of California, San Francisco. So it's probably what we'd accept for COVID, she said. As of June 3rd, COVID-19 was killing an average of 363 Americans a day, according to the CDC. That's down from more than 3,000 a day at the height of the pandemic in January. And with more vaccinations, the daily death toll continues to fall. Experts note that SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19 could be almost entirely controlled in the U.S. with near-universal vaccination, if Americans were willing. That's how smallpox was eradicated in 1980. But the waning of the COVID-19 pandemic will be spotty. To an epidemiologist, a pandemic is a worldwide spread of a new disease. An epidemic is an unexpected increase of a disease in a given geographic area. A disease becomes endemic when it is always present, but limited to a particular group or region. Right now, COVID-19 is a pandemic globally, an epidemic in the United States, and on the cusp of being endemic in highly vaccinated areas. There will effectively be two Americas, one vaccinated, the other not. Last month, Governor Jared Polis of Colorado noted, "If you have been fully vaccinated, the pandemic is largely over for you. For the unvaccinated, it won't be. If they get sick, there's just as much chance of them getting severely ill or dying from COVID-19 as there is today." In the end, only high levels of vaccination will truly allow the entire country to return to normal, said Dr. Walter Orenstein, Associate Director of the Emory Vaccine Center and former Director of the Immunization Program at the CDC. "This virus," he told public health officers, "will not eradicate itself." Okay, well, as the science of understanding COVID-19 improves, this article here from Medical Express gives us a look back and a look to the future. Study of UK dental professionals shows extent of occupational risk of SARS-CoV-2 infection. A University of Birmingham-led study of over 1,000 dental professionals has shown their increased occupational risk of SARS-CoV-2 infection during the first wave of the pandemic in the UK. The team found 16.3% of study participants, which included dentists, dental nurses, and dental hygienists, had SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, compared to just 6% of the general population at the time. Meanwhile, the percentage of dental practice receptionists who have no direct patient contact with SARS-CoV-2 antibodies was comparable to the general population, supporting the hypothesis that occupational risk arose from close exposure to patients. The results showed that those who had previous COVID-19 infection, over 70% continued to have SARS-CoV-2 antibodies both at 3 months and 6 months later, and they were at a 75% reduced risk of reinfection with the virus. Furthermore, none of the cohort with a level of SARS-CoV-2 antibodies greater than 148 international units of milliliter per milliliter in their blood tested positive for COVID-19 throughout the six-month period from the first to the final blood test. Critically, only 5% of the cohort developed an antibody response that exceeded this threshold following the first wave of the UK pandemic. This suggests that natural infection alone is unlikely to generate meaningful, durable herd immunity. So the good news is this, is that people definitely did get some protection. We're at 75% reduced risk of reinfection with the virus if they had previously been infected. But very few, only about 5% of the folks who had an antibody response actually had a level that would definitely prevent reinfection. So that over time would be expected to wane too. So this is another example of why people that have been infected need to get vaccinated as well. And the even better news is that if you've been previously infected and you get a vaccine, you really get a supercharge of antibodies and probably have the best protection of all in the world. So get vaccinated. Okay, well, while over half of Americans are vaccinated now, the amount of people getting newly vaccinated is plummeting here. So this from the Washington Post: vaccination rates fall off, imperiling Biden's July 4th goal. Plummeting vaccination rates have turned what officials hoped would be a last mile of the coronavirus immunization campaign into a marathon, threatening President Biden's goal of getting shots to at least 70% of adults by July 4th. The United States is averaging fewer than 1 million shots per day, a decline of more than two-thirds from the peak of 3.4 million in April, according to the Washington Post's seven-day analysis. even though all adults and children over age 12 are now eligible. The slowdown is national, with every state down at least two-thirds from its peak, and particularly felt across the South and Midwest. But the picture varies considerably across the country. 13 mostly East and West Coast states have already vaccinated 70% of adult residents, and another 15 states plus the District of Columbia are over 60% and will likely reach Biden's goal. So that puts us at 28 states, a little over half the states. The rest are lagging behind. Only 2.4 million adults got their first shot last week. Officials must get a first dose to 4.2 million adults per week to meet Biden's goal of ensuring that 70% of adults are at least partially vaccinated by Independence Day. So again, this just accents what I've been reporting on, the fact that we have two Americas, a vaccinated and an unvaccinated America, and it looks that Biden, who has been noted for having his under-promising and over-performing, may have met his match with his July 4th goal. But of course, in public health, we're in this for the long haul. So keep vaccinating, and we'll continue to keep vaccinating until we get to a level that hopefully can prevent major outbreaks when flu season comes in the fall, which of course means COVID-19 season. Okay, well, some hard-to-reach populations have had some success. This from Medical Express. Some prisons highly successful in vaccinating inmates. Some prison systems in the United States have been able to vaccinate high numbers of inmates against COVID-19, and that success could point to ways to convince skeptical people in the general public to get vaccinated. For example, more than 80% of inmates in North Dakota and about 73% of inmates in California and Kansas have received at least one vaccine dose, while the overall rates among residents in those states are 42%, 56%, and 47% respectively, the New York Times reported. Education is really key, says Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein, a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and leader of the COVID Prison Project, which monitors coronavirus cases in correctional facilities and gathers data on vaccination rates in those settings. Especially in a prison context where there tends to be a lot of distrust of both healthcare staff and correctional staff, that education piece becomes even more important. In Kansas, inmates were prioritized for vaccinations and vaccine information was provided to inmates and their relatives. In Rhode Island, former inmates helped create a vaccination plan for inmates. One California prison held a town hall-style meeting for inmates where medical experts answered questions about COVID-19 vaccine safety. So keep it going, people. Okay, well, while the U.S. continues to slog out making progress in getting its own population vaccinated, we're in a worldwide pandemic where the rest of the world is not doing nearly as well. And I've got in front of me here a letter to President Biden from a bunch of progressive congressional Democrats. And I thought this was a very good outline of what needs to be done worldwide. So here goes. Dear President Biden, we write you regarding the urgent crisis of vaccine equity in the world and urge you to take aggressive and immediate steps to ensure vaccines are quickly administered in countries around the world to mitigate COVID-19 globally. We appreciate the steps you've already taken, including your support of the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, a temporary waiver for COVID-19 vaccines at the World Trade Organization, and we look forward to working with you to secure its adoption. We also applaud your commitment to sending a total of 80 million doses of FDA-authorized COVID-19 vaccines to countries battling the pandemic by the end of June. These are important steps forward. However, much more must be done. We urge you to pursue additional steps to advance a bold, comprehensive strategy to vaccinate the world as quickly as possible. As you know, wealthy countries have administered more than 80% of global vaccines, while low-income countries have received just 0.3%. The New York Times editorial board recently issued a dire warning that, quote, without a major course correction, the rest of the world will have to wait until 2023 or later for large-scale vaccination initiatives. A preventable humanitarian catastrophe that heightens the risk of the emergence of a vaccine-resistant viral strain that could impact all Americans. We are ready to partner with your administration on the following five measures to achieve our shared goal of a rapid and equitable global vaccination program. Ensure the immediate release of the 80 million doses of the vaccine. Currently, we understand the countries experiencing immediate surges have not received sufficient doses. It is imperative that the committed doses are allocated based on where surging numbers are greatest, immediately. We also urge you to reassess our stockpile of vaccines to release even more vaccines immediately to countries around the world. Invest an additional $25 billion in the Build Back Better agenda to authorize the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, to oversee the production of 8 billion mRNA vaccine doses, sufficient to vaccinate half the world. This is one of the quickest ways to increase the immediate supply of vaccines globally. We ask that you provide an immediate accounting of the remainder of the $16 billion in American Rescue Plan funds allocated for vaccine development, manufacturing, distribution, and supply chains, and utilize that to immediately deploy towards expanding production. Use all available tools of U.S. influence, persuasion, diplomacy, and legal authorities to facilitate the rapid and widespread transfer of technology and expansion of vaccine production, including directing the NIH to participate in the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Technology Access Pool Program, identifying and supporting suitable firms and facilities worldwide that have sought licensing agreements to manufacture vaccines but have been rebuffed, and negotiating and securing vaccine licensing agreements with existing manufacturers to enable broad sharing of vaccine technology and industrial processes to scale up production, recognizing the potential leverage afforded by the Defense Production Act, the Bayh-Dole Act, and 28 U.S.C. 1498 for U.S.-owned patents on mRNA vaccine innovation. Support a new issuance of special drawing rights, a cost-free International Monetary Fund reserve asset to help strengthen public health budgets worldwide and provide low-income countries with resources to import medical supplies and carry out vaccination campaigns, building on the $650 billion global allocation expected to be issued in August. This should be paired and supported through the State Department, USAID, and U.S. membership at the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and other agencies to help expand developing countries' technical capacities and health infrastructure to universally administer vaccines. Convene a global vaccine summit with world leaders, allies, and adversaries alike to spur cooperation and coordination in the development, production, and distribution of vaccines, encouraging research transparency, open access, and global collaboration in engineering and manufacturing, with a goal of accelerating universal vaccination. There are numerous reasons to engage immediately and aggressively in showing strong leadership in helping to vaccinate the world. First, from a public health perspective, if we are to defeat the virus, we cannot allow the continued surges globally because the virus knows no geographic boundaries and the public health of Americans is at risk. Second, the humanitarian and economic implications of a needlessly prolonged, years-long global pandemic are dire, as explosive surges of infections and deaths in India and Brazil and the spread of a new highly infectious variant demonstrate. Not only will many more hundreds of thousands die from COVID-19, but tens of millions more will experience increased poverty, hunger, and instability. Third, this is a prime opportunity to strengthen diplomatic relationships and to show people around the world that America is a power that comes to their aid when they are in need and a country that still does big and great things. The world cannot wait. It is imperative that the United States act quickly and deploy every tool in our arsenal. Now is the time to build international cooperation and solidarity in ways we have never seen before, using the full force of U.S. diplomacy, economic and commercial leadership, legal authorities, and membership in multilateral institutions. The fate of our own health and safety in the U.S. is inextricably connected to the well-being and protection of the most vulnerable among us worldwide. We look forward to collaborating with you on this shared priority, signed by a bunch of members of Congress, all progressive Democrats. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit from the global and national focus to a local COVID-19 update. And the state of Ohio has dropped most of its COVID-19 restrictions, and little Ohio does seem to be doing much better. We're seeing like an acceleration or an inflection point here. This is good news. So in Lucas County, the average number of daily cases over the last 7 days dropped from 35 to 13 over the last week. Somewhat elusive rate of under 50 that the governor had set for getting rid of restrictions, which of course he ignored, we're almost down to that. And by one of the state measures, they met it on Saturday, But the Lucas County rate is at 71 and the Ohio rate is at 63 as of Sunday. But the testing positivity rate, the number of people that are, the percent of people that are getting tested that test positive, dropped from 3.2 to 2.2% in Lucas County. And this is pretty much the same as the Ohio rate. So we've closed that gap as both continue to drop, in this case, pretty precipitously. The state rate is 2.1%. County rate 2.2%. Very good, Ohio and Lucas County. And we finally saw a good drop in the number of nursing home cases, down to 6 cases, 2 residents and 4 staff in Lucas County. This is still not quite the low. We've had 5 and 4 a couple months ago there, but then it kind of crept back up. But looks like it's going back down. Good news. And new hospitalizations are trending down in both Lucas County and Ohio in recent weeks, and this trend down is accelerating. So it looks like the lag we're seeing in hospitalizations is finally catching up with the big drop in cases. Unfortunately, the Lucas County deaths over the last 14 days had a big jump up to 17 from 11, as reported last week. So COVID has still been killing people in Lucas County. It ain't over yet. As far as vaccines go, Ohio and Lucas County continue to just lag behind the U.S. as a whole. We're 5 or 6% behind the nation as a whole in the percentage of the population. We're like 45 or 46% compared to almost 52% for the nation as a whole. But the bottom line is that locally and statewide, we are doing a lot better and the trends look generally very good. Okay, well, you're listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. My promise to you is that if you listen to this show for a whole year, that you will know more about public health than 99% of your neighbors. Okay, well, let's transition from COVID-19 and get in some other public health news. This from The Hill: how COVID-19 lessons can transform U.S. mental health care in the future. Almost 20 years ago, the President's New Freedom Commission took a hard look at mental health care and proposed solutions bearing an uncanny resemblance to those in circulation today. Expand telehealth to improve access to care, screen for mental disorders in primary care, and launch a national campaign to reduce stigma and prevent suicide. While the U.S. health system has made other strides since then, these 3 recommendations represent points where COVID-19 might finally galvanize overdue change. Telehealth has been bandied about by policymakers for decades. A trove of evidence has shown that, for conditions such as anxiety and depression, it can be as effective as in-person care. Nevertheless, adoption has been incremental. Many private insurers declined to pay psychiatrists, psychologists, and counselors at rates comparable to in-person visits, if at all. There are also gaps in available insurance billing codes. Enter COVID-19. When the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cautioned against seeking non-essential medical services, mental health care plummeted. A survey by the National Council found that roughly 50% of interviewed behavioral health clinics had to lay off or furlough staff. In response, federal and state lawmakers temporarily bolstered telehealth, for example, allowing use of video conferencing platforms like Zoom, issuing new reimbursement codes to cover payment for telehealth, and establishing mandates that private health insurers must pay for telehealth services. As a result, the landscape of mental health service today looks remarkably different, with treatment by phone or video conference a staple feature. But this progress could be lost. Absent some federal change, governors could dissolve mandates compelling private insurers to pay for telehealth. Will providers then continue to offer these services? Probably not. A long-standing priority of mental health care advocates has been to ensure mental health and physical health care go hand in hand, including screening and treating mental health conditions in primary care, commonly called integrated care. Over the past 15 years, there has been overwhelming evidence these models work. The University of Washington's Ames Center has documented over 90 randomized controlled trials showing that a version of this, called the collaborative care model, improves both mental and physical health outcomes for patients. Cost analysis indicate that for every $1 invested, there is a $12.75 return at the society level. Let me repeat that. This is public health. Prevention is worth a pound of cure. Cost analysis indicate that for every $1 invested in the community collaborative care model, there is a $12.75 return at the societal level. So this works. Why are we not doing it? Okay, back to the story. And yet, few practices have implemented this model. Why? Because mom-and-pop health clinics operate much differently than academic medical centers, where clinical trials typically take place. Asking smaller clinics to screen and treat mental health conditions affects everything from personnel to clinical workflow to billing systems. These upfront efforts, coupled with insufficient reimbursement rates, undermine the incentive to adopt integrated care. But COVID-19 has changed the conversation. Psychological distress, anxiety and depression, the secondary traumas of the pandemic, are affecting millions more Americans. In surveys, 4 in 10 adults reported elevated anxiety or depression during the past week during the pandemic. This level of need suggests that screening for mental health conditions should be as commonplace as measuring patients' blood pressure. Rates of suicide among adolescents and young adults have increased by more than 50% over the past decade, despite efforts to destigmatize mental illness and thereby increase treatment seeking. Over the same period, one-off anti-stigma campaigns produced a mixed bag of results. A 2018 review by the National Academy of Sciences concluded, because these efforts are largely uncoordinated and poorly evaluated, they cannot provide an evidence base for future national efforts. An alternative vision is one in which children and adolescents receive consistent exposure to anti-stigma messaging. Schools are an excellent place to start. The most robust studies indicate that school-based mental health awareness programs are associated with improvements in mental health knowledge, attitudes, and willingness to seek treatment. However, a minority of states currently have a mental health curriculum required by law, and the scope, scale, and content of these curricula vary widely. In 2018, New York became one of the first states to institute a K-12 mental health education curriculum. The federal government could consider providing guidance on minimum standards for mental health education like those established by New York, fund and support curriculum development, and provide materials for dissemination through the Department of Education. Over the past few weeks, Congress held hearings on ways to improve mental health care in the wake of the pandemic. Where the new Freedom Commission came up short 20 years ago, Congress now has an opportunity to make transformative changes today. There are several tangible next steps it could take. They include shoring up the advances in telehealth, at the very least a permanent extension of payment parity. If these mandates are rescinded, we will lose a valuable tool for reaching underserved communities. Investments in broadband infrastructure go hand in hand with this strategy. Federal agencies like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services also could examine hurdles for care integration models like the collaborative care model. If the root cause for poor adoption is the practice transformation required, the Biden administration could consider an initiative similar to the Transforming Clinical Practice Initiative, through which thousands of clinical practices overhauled their payment systems. Lastly, states like New York are providing a blueprint for weaving anti-stigma campaigns into the fabric of our education system. With the return of millions of students who have been socially isolated while out of school, there's no time like the present to consider bolstering mental health literacy. It would be a powerful conclusion to the COVID-19 pandemic if, in the wake of the destruction caused by the virus, Americans reimagined a health system that was resilient against future threats, including the resulting psychological trauma. Policymakers have the opportunity now to cut short the pandemic's long tail of mental illness by taking decisive action. Okay, well, let's work for a rosier mental health future for America. But as we know, evidence and public health practice experience that works is not necessarily paid attention to. And that cues up this next story from USA Today. Controversial Indiana needle exchange program that quelled massive HIV outbreak voted down. An Indiana county, once home to America's worst drug-fueled HIV outbreak, voted last Wednesday to scrap the syringe exchange program credited with halting the epidemic. The Scott County Commission vote, with 2 of 3 members arguing the exchange could be contributing to drug use and overdose deaths, drew howls of protest from health advocates who predicted it would lead to a resurgence of HIV cases. The move comes amid a nationwide increase in drug overdoses attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic, leading supporters to argue there could scarcely be a worse time to abandon the harm reduction program serving a one-time epicenter of the U.S. opioid crisis. Commissioners rejected pleas from local law enforcement, state officials, and former Trump administration Surgeon General Jerome Adams in voting to shutter the exchange, opened to fight a 2015 HIV outbreak fueled by injected opioids that saw cases skyrocket from a small handful of 237 in a county of just 24,000. The syringe exchange, opened over the initial opposition of then-Governor Mike Pence, works by offering clients clean needles they must return to limit sharing of infected needles. In addition, clients get access to treatment and overdose reversal drugs. Dr. William Cook, who opened the town's only primary care doctor's office in 2004 and worked to help curtail the outbreak, said the exchange has proven successful and become a national model. In 2018, researchers with the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found the proportion who shared syringes in Scott County dropped from 74% to 22% from 2015 to 2018. Last year, the county had just one HIV case, officials said, from a high of more than 150 in a year. In a hearing last month, advocates cited decades of research showing syringe exchange programs prevent disease and reduce healthcare costs without increasing crime, and it serves as a critical touch point with drug users for treatment and overdose reversing naloxone, Dr. Cook said. Advocates said exchanges are more needed than ever as part of a one-stop shop set up by the state that offers not just syringes, but HIV testing, immunizations, and referrals for substance abuse and counseling. Exchanges are not meant by themselves to reduce drug abuse, supporters argued, but rather reduce life-threatening illnesses that stem from reusing contaminated needles. Without it, a surge in HIV and other drug-related infections such as hepatitis C is nearly inevitable, Dr. Cook and others argued. That's what happened in West Virginia, where access to needle exchanges has been curtailed in recent years, prompting HIV rates to rise. The CDC deemed 220 U.S. counties vulnerable to similar outbreaks because of overdose death rates, the volume of prescription opioid sales, and other statistics tied to injecting drugs. Yet a Kaiser Health News analysis shows fewer than a third of those counties have working syringe exchanges. Shame on you, Scott County Commission, Indiana. You were a leader, now you're a laggard. We need to reverse directions and continue to go forward. Okay, well, next up, a little more optimistic story about public attitudes. This from Medical Express. Most Americans support Medicare negotiation, despite claims it would hurt innovation. A new West Health Gallup survey finds nearly all Democrats, 97%, and the majority of Republicans, 61%, support empowering the federal government to negotiate lower prices of brand-name prescription drugs covered by Medicare. Overall, 8 in 10 Americans prefer major government action to control prices over concerns about it hurting innovation and competition from the pharmaceutical industry. The results come from a nationally representative poll of more than 3,700 American adults. When choosing between the need for major reform in drug pricing and maintaining the status quo, 90% of Americans choose to support reforms, including 96% of Democrats, 88% of Independents, and 83% of Republicans. Sweeping support also exists for specific actions, including setting limits on out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs, 87% strongly or somewhat supporting, and general health care, 84%, in Medicare, and limiting hospital charges for those with private insurance, 83%, and allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices for all Americans, not just Medicare beneficiaries, is supported by 70% of respondents. There is little question that substantial public support exists for more government action when it comes to addressing drug costs, said Dan Witters, Gallup senior researcher. And while there are differences across the political spectrum, even among Republicans, sentiment for public action is substantial. Who knows? This overwhelming public support may bode well for growing support for Medicare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely, It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, and more optimistic news, this from Medical Express. The United Nations optimistic on conquering AIDS by 2030. 40 years on since the first AIDS cases were reported, the United Nations said it is cautiously optimistic that the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, the virus that causes the disease, could be beaten by 2030. The UNAIDS agency said at least 40 countries were on track to achieve a 90% drop in AIDS-related mortality by 2030, including 9 countries in Eastern and Southern Africa. In a report, the Joint UN Program on HIV and AIDS said that 37.6 million people worldwide were living with HIV in 2020. Of those, 27.4 million were receiving treatment, more than three times the 7.8 million in 2010. The rollout of affordable, quality treatment is estimated to have averted 16.2 million deaths since 2001. Over the decade, the number of AIDS-related deaths fell by 43% to 690,000 in 2020, in large part due to the rollout of antiviral therapy. But progress in reducing new HIV infections was slower, down 30% since 2010, with 1.5 million people newly infected with the virus last year, compared to 2.1 million in the year 2010. UNAIDS said that the AIDS-related illness remains the leading cause of death among women aged 15 to 49 in sub-Saharan Africa. 6 out of 7 new HIV infections among adolescents aged 15 to 19 years in the region are among girls. UNAIDS Director Winnie Binyama said she was cautiously optimistic that the 2030 target could be met. High-performing countries have provided paths for others to follow, she told reporters. We are asking governments to focus on the inequalities that stop people from accessing services. If they can close these gaps for the particular groups that are most at risk, we can end AIDS by 2030. UNAIDS set new targets to reach by 2025, bringing HIV services to 95% of those who need them, reducing annual HIV infections to fewer than 370,000, and reducing AIDS-related deaths to fewer than 250,000 by 2025. The agency said an investment of $29 billion a year is needed. She called for the same political will that has gone into tackling the COVID-19 pandemic to be applied towards the fight against AIDS. She said the coronavirus crisis has had several worrying impacts, notably stretching the health systems of countries suffering from the highest HIV burden, while accessing services has become more difficult due to lockdowns. AIDS remains unfinished business, she said. I call on all activists the world over to renew our energy and our drive to push towards ending AIDS by 2030. Okay, next up, I got a couple stories about racism and health inequities. This from Stat News. Changing the equation. Researchers remove race from a calculator for childbirth. Since 2007, obstetricians have counseled patients planning to give birth after a previous C-section with help from a simple calculator designed to determine the likelihood of having successful vaginal birth after a cesarean. The tool takes into account a patient's age, height, weight, and their history of vaginal and cesarean delivery. It also asks 2 yes or no questions. African American? Hispanic? The answers can predict a drastically lower chance of success for patients of color. But now, after years of work by researchers, advocates, and clinicians, that racialized calculator has been replaced by a newly validated version that is the same in almost every way, except for eliminating race and ethnicity as a risk factor. The calculator is just one of several clinical algorithms that have been recently been challenged over their use of race adjustment. Providers across specialties have questioned the inclusion of race and ethnicity, which are social, not biological factors, in their decision-making tools, pointing to the risk of perpetuating existing health inequities. But these obstetricians access the calculator online, it could prove much easier than with other corrected tools to get the updated calculator quickly into use across the country. They put it there because the outcomes that are based on societal and structural norms that lead to these differences appear epidemiologically, said Audra Meadows, a co-author of the paper, who was previously the medical director of ambulatory obstetrics. But in the end, it's hurting the option to try to have a vaginal birth. That, in turn, could disproportionately point patients of color toward a potentially riskier procedure, reinforcing the extreme inequities in maternal medicine. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women, a disparity attributed in part to higher C-section rates. While a repeat C-section is a safer choice than laboring for many patients, a successful vaginal birth after C-section reduces maternal risk for blood transfusion, unplanned hysterectomies, and trips to the ICU. The analysis behind the updated tool affirms that choice, showing it performs with the same level of accuracy as the previous version. The updated calculator also includes a new objective clinical variable, whether or not a patient has been treated for chronic hypertension. Good news and a little chipping away at the racism in our healthcare system. But the next story is a good example of how it can take a long time to get there regarding racism in our healthcare system. This from Medical Express. People of color twice as likely to die after traumatic brain injury, new study finds. People of color are more than twice as likely to die after traumatic brain injury as white people, according to a new retrospective review from Oregon Health and Science University. In the report, Racial and Ethnic Inequities in Mortality During Hospitalization for Traumatic Brain Injury, A Call to Action, the researchers analyzed more than a decade of data related to the health outcomes and demographics of thousands of patients treated for traumatic head injuries at the Oregon Health and Science University Hospital, one of two Level 1 trauma centers in the state. They found a clear delineation of worse outcomes for people of color. We have a societal and professional duty to recognize and accept that the effects of structural racism have taken hold of our patients' health long before they arrive in our trauma bays, ICU beds, and operating tables, they write. These disparities permeate our society and contribute to inequitable health outcomes, and we must take action to identify the factors which perpetuate this disproportionate suffering. The researchers found no bias in the treatment patients received while in the hospital. Measurements including the number of days spent in intensive care and charges for hospital services were similar between groups. Rather, they say the findings highlight underlying disparities in health that disproportionately affect people of color. If you ran the same analysis with patients with pneumonia, you might find the same results, said senior author Ahmed Rosland, associate professor of neurological surgery. Our findings point to the problem in a more robust and clear way. The problem is rooted in social determinants of health, including factors such as diet, lifestyle, occupations, and access to health care. The study is the first to review racial and ethnic disparities in the field of neurosurgical trauma. So the point being, as a kind of a comparison between the medical system and the larger public health system, is that these social determinants happen outside the hospital. So even if you perfectly treat and have absolutely no racism in the healthcare system, you're still going to see these disparities because the disparities are actually rooted in stuff that happens before you even walk through the hospital door. We have a long way to go. Thanks for that call to action. Okay, well, let's move on to sexism. This from Scientific American. Biomedical research falls short at factoring in sex and gender. Picture a person having a heart attack. What do you see? Most likely a man, looking sweaty and short of breath, clutching his arm or chest in pain. This canonical image has been so deeply impressed into our minds that it may be hard to believe heart attacks could look like anything else. But when women have heart attacks, their symptoms can be quite different, presenting as deep fatigue, nausea and vomiting, and more widespread bodily discomfort instead of localized pain. Discrepancies like this, between what we expect a medical condition to look like and the various forms it might take in real life, can have devastating consequences. Most often, men's symptom profiles are considered the, quote, textbook cases, and so when women present with different symptoms, they may be misdiagnosed, resulting in delays or possible deprival of life-saving interventions. To exacerbate things further, women are more likely to report later to the hospital, defined as waiting 12 hours or longer after symptom onset than men, a consequence in large part to the confusion over symptomatology. The failure to consider the influence of sex and gender on health physiology goes beyond the clinic. In laboratories around the world, most scientists have historically chosen to study only male rats and mice under the faulty assumption that female animals' fluctuating hormones would make their data messy and hard to interpret. Like humans, female rodents undergo reproductive cycles characterized by phases of high and low circulating estrogen, which has the potential to influence experimental outcomes. However, what most researchers fail to acknowledge is that males also display significant daily fluctuations in hormone levels, primarily testosterone, that may also influence experimental outcomes. Interestingly, recent analyses of thousands of scientific publications found that data collected from male and female rodents are pretty much equally messy. And if anything, males displayed more variability overall than females. Thus, this type of overall noise in scientific results is normal. What have we been missing by excluding female animals from preclinical research? In our field of neuroscience alone, we see evidence for sex differences in a wide variety of neural processes, including spatial navigation, learning strategies, and pain transmission, demonstrating that evolution has equipped the mammalian nervous system with not one but multiple ways to experience and adapt to the world around us. But despite these exciting findings, investigations into the biological mechanisms that underlie fundamental phenomena like memory or sensory processing have by and large been conducted only in males. Even when studying diseases that affect more women than men, like Alzheimer's disease, major depressive disorder, or stroke, scientists more often than not choose to work exclusively with males. In recent years, the government agencies that fund biomedical research, like the National Institute of Health in the U.S., have begun to recognize that the neglect of females as research subjects may lead to serious public health problems as basic science findings make their way into the clinical pipeline for treatment. In addition to misdiagnoses, women are also more likely to experience negative side effects from drug treatment, possibly a consequence of those drugs not being tested in female rodents during the early stages of drug discovery. To address these issues, the NIH implemented a policy in 2015 mandating consideration of, quote, sex as a biological variable. This initiative requires scientists applying for funding to incorporate both male and female animals into their experimental design unless a research topic, such as pregnancy, is by definition sex-specific. Important, these guidelines do not require scientists to specifically assess sex differences in their studies. However, many scientists initially protest, and continue to do so, that the new policy would require them to essentially double the number of animals they used, thereby preventing their grant dollars from stretching as far. Others claim that they would in fact have to quadruple their animal numbers to account for every phase of the female reproductive cycle. The idea that hormones are a critical consideration for research in female subjects, but not male subjects, is rooted in long-standing sexist stereotypes that contradict actual scientific evidence. Males, of course, have hormones too, which can rise or fall depending on their social hierarchy status in their cage, the type of food they are fed, and the time of day. But as we noted above, fluctuating hormones in animals of either sex do not create the problematic, messy data sets that many scientists have assumed. Requiring the use of male and female animals in biomedical research is an important first step in disabusing scientists and society of the flawed notion that males are a standard form of which females might deviate. As we can see in human medicine, treating men's cases as a default measuring stick can have dire consequences. Rather, treating all research subjects as equally valuable in our quest for knowledge is critical to rectifying sex and gender-based health disparities. Unfortunately, there is yet another force working against the rapid adoption of these sex as a biological variable practices, the culture of academic publishing. The expression publisher perish probably rings true for most researchers. However, the real currency in academic science is not just any publication, but a paper in a high-profile journal like Science or Nature. These journals are known for being extremely selective in what they choose to publish, and having a Science or Nature paper is often an unspoken requirement for faculty hiring and promotion at prestigious universities. However, these journals have historically valued preclinical research that takes a deeper dive into its topic within a single sex, usually males. rather than research which takes the time to ask questions in both males and females. We therefore end up with an incentive structure that pits personal prestige and career advancement against more rigorous, equitable investigations into biological processes and mechanisms of disease. In 2016, the journal Research Integrity and Peer Review published guidelines for sex and gender equity in research, which provides clear steps for scientists and editors to increase equity, accuracy, and transparency in both the conduct and reporting of research in subjects of both sexes. These guidelines clearly state that experiments should be designed to reveal sex or gender differences, and that single-sex studies require justification for the exclusion of either sex. Sadly, few, if any, journals have incorporated these guidelines into their publishing policies. The world of biomedical science is long overdue for a realignment of its reward system with public health goals. Human bodies and brains are complicated, and our job as basic scientists is to lay the foundational knowledge that will ultimately inform personalized medicine. This should mean embracing the noise, seeing variability in experimental outcomes as an opportunity to understand the scope of what is possible, not an inconvenience to be swept under the rug in the futile pursuit of a single and rapid, quote, right answer. But as long as high-profile journals continue to put their seal of approval on work that only examines males, scientists will continue to deprioritize research in female subjects, or simply not do it at all. Journal editors, peer reviewers, tenure committees, and others in gatekeeping positions have the power to shape what prestigious science looks like. It's time to step up and shift scientific culture to value rigorous research that includes both sexes. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears now and close the show with a few articles about climate change and the environment. This from the Associated Press. Study blames climate change for 37% of global heat deaths. More than one-third of the world's heat deaths each year are due directly to global warming, according to the latest study to calculate the human cost of climate change. But scientists say that's only a sliver of climate's overall toll. Even more people die from other extreme weather amplified by global warming, such as storms, flooding, and drought. And the heat death numbers will grow exponentially with rising temperatures. People continue to ask for proof that climate change is already affecting our health. This attribution study directly answers that question using state-of-the-science epidemiological methods, and the amount of data the authors have amassed for analysis is impressive, said Dr. Jonathan Patz, director of Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin. Patz, who wasn't part of the study, said it was one of the first to detail climate change-related heat deaths now rather than in the future. And as most people are familiar, COVID-19 has been an economic crisis across the world as well. But as a matter of perspective and context, this from The Hill: climate crisis will crush world's biggest nations twice as hard as COVID-19, says new study. The economic effects of climate change could more than double the damage to the world's richest countries than the financial crisis brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. G7 economies contracted by more than 4% due to the pandemic. The world stands to lose close to 10% of total economic value by mid-century if climate change stays on the currently anticipated trajectory and the Paris Climate Agreement and 2050 net zero emissions targets are not met, researchers wrote in their findings. And of course, the real clincher of this is that hopefully the coronavirus effect on our economy is passing and will only last a matter of a year or two or three at most. But if we're seeing climate changes, this could be essentially permanent and twice as big as COVID. Look out, people. Time to deal with climate crises. Okay, for the last story of the episode, I'm going to do an environmental story as well. This from Scientific American. Pesticides are killing the world's soils. Scoop up a shovel of healthy soil and you'll likely be holding more living organisms than there are people on the planet Earth. Like citizens of an underground city that never sleeps, tens of thousands of subterranean species of invertebrates, nematodes, bacteria, and fungi are constantly filtering our water, recycling nutrients, and helping to regulate the Earth's temperature. But beneath fields covered in tightly knit rows of corn, soybeans, wheat, and other monoculture crops, a toxic soup of insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides is wreaking havoc, according to a newly published analysis in the journal Frontiers in Environmental Science. The study, the most comprehensive review ever conducted of how pesticides affect soil health, should trigger immediate and substantive changes in how regulatory agencies like the EPA assess the risks posed by the nearly 850 pesticide ingredients approved for use in the U.S. Currently, regulators completely ignore pesticides' harm to earthworms, springtails, beetles, and thousands of other subterranean species. Our study leaves no doubt that must change. For our analysis conducted by researchers at the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Earth, and the University of Maryland, we looked at nearly 400 published studies that together conducted over 2,800 experiments on how pesticides affect soil organisms. Our review encompassed 275 unique species or types of soil organisms and 284 different pesticides or pesticide mixtures. In just over 70% of those experiments, pesticides were found to harm organisms that are critical to maintaining healthy soils, harms that currently are never considered in the EPA's safety reviews. The ongoing escalation of pesticide-intensive agriculture and pollution are major driving factors in the precipitous decline of many soil organisms, like ground beetles and ground nesting bees. They have been identified as the most significant driver of soil biodiversity loss in the past decade. Yet pesticide companies and our pesticide regulators have ignored that research. The EPA, which is responsible for pesticide oversight in the U.S., openly acknowledges that somewhere between 50% to 100% of all agriculturally applied pesticides end up in the soil. Yet to assess pesticides' harms to soil species, the agency still uses a single test species, one that spends its entire life above ground in artificial boxes to estimate risk to all soil organisms, the European honeybee. The fact that the EPA relies on a species that literally may never touch soil in its entire life to represent the thousands of species that live or develop underground offers a disturbing glimpse of how the U.S. pesticide regulatory system is set up to protect the pesticide industry instead of species and their ecosystems. What this ultimately means is that pesticide approvals happen without any regard to how these pesticides can harm soil organisms. To add to this, the principles of regenerative agriculture and soil health gain popularity around the world. Pesticide companies have jumped on the bandwagon to greenwash their products. Every major pesticide company now has web materials touting its role in promoting soil health, often advocating for reducing tilling and planting cover crops. As general principles, both of these practices are indeed good for soil health and, if adopted responsibly, are great steps to take. However, pesticide companies know that these practices are often accompanied by increased pesticide use. When fields aren't tilled, pesticides are often used to kill weeds, and cover crops are often killed by pesticides before crop planting. This one step forward, one step back approach is preventing meaningful progress to protect our soils. Pesticide companies have so far been successful in co-opting healthy soil messaging because our regulators have demonstrated no desire or willingness to protect soil organisms from pesticides. The long-term environmental cost of that failure can no longer be ignored. Soils are some of the most complex and biodiverse ecosystems on the planet, containing nearly a quarter of the planet's diversity. Protecting them should be a priority, not an afterthought. Our research indicates that achieving this will require that we face the task of reducing the world's growing and unsustainable addiction to pesticide-intensive agriculture, and it will require that the EPA take aggressive steps to begin protecting the health of our soil by addressing the well-documented harms of pesticides to our long-overlooked subterranean species. Okay, well, that does it for today's regular programming, but I do have five bonus articles, and I'll give you the link online to read these. One, medical journals blind to racism as health crisis, critics say. As a prominent editor steps down, the influential JAMA journals promise changes regarding staff diversity and more inclusive research. Two, we're overlooking a major culprit in the opioid crisis. Pharmaceutical companies and drug dealers have been part of the problem, but so have policymakers. Three, why deadly black fungus is ravaging COVID patients in India. Standard treatments such as steroids, as well as illnesses such as diabetes, make the fungal infections worse. Four, the grief pandemic will torment Americans for years. And finally, but not last, lastly but not least, five, a pandemic upside. The flu virus became less diverse, simplifying the task of making flu shots, which are often difficult to predict. You can read these bonus articles and the articles that I've covered in this episode and in past episodes. Go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.